All right, it appears that both attorneys in the second case are online and are ready to begin. So I will call the second case for oral argument today is number A22-0688, Marcia Swanson versus Denise Wolfe. I trust that both attorneys, I know that you both understand our general procedures, which are essentially the same, even though we are using the Zoom format. You should be able to see the time clock on your screen if you're using the gallery setting or some other similar setting. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and then begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent appellant Denise Wolfe. Your Honors, this case presents an issue of interpretation of the probate statutes in Minnesota. And specifically in this case, the appellant Denise Wolfe seeks to enforce those statutes and give them the vitality that the legislature intended. The respondent, on the other hand, seeks to rewrite the statute or to ignore the material requirements contained in the statute. The real issue here is this distinction between in personam and in rem jurisdiction under Chapter 501C. So we begin with the undisputed fact that there is no in personam jurisdiction in this case. The district court found there was not in personam jurisdiction. The respondent makes no argument that there ever was in personam jurisdiction established. So we are left strictly with this, with the in rem jurisdiction that the district court then utilized to allow this issue of the removal of the trustee to be addressed. Initially, it's important to recognize that the distinction between in rem and in personam jurisdiction matters. The legislature created that distinction. If you look back at 501B, it spoke specifically and only about in rem jurisdiction. When the legislature passed 501C, they amended that and they added the provisions related to in personam jurisdiction. In rem jurisdiction, by statutory definition, deals with the property, the assets contained in the trust. In personam jurisdiction, again by statutory definition, deals with the people, deals with the trustee, deals with beneficiaries, and deals with the language or terms of the trust itself. So if you want to dispute any of those people-related or document-related terms or issues, you have to establish in personam jurisdiction. And the legislature then went further and it gave specific rules for creating in personam versus in rem jurisdiction, and they're very different. Specifically for in personam jurisdiction, you have to, anyone trying to raise in personam jurisdiction has to file a or prepare a petition which includes the language in it that the petition is invoking the
Can I just ask you to go back a bit? I like the clarity of in rem deals with the property, in personam deals with the people. But when I'm looking at 501c.0202 subject matter of judicial proceedings, it's not, it doesn't set it out that clearly. You know, it just says, here are things you can do instead of like, here's what you can do in rem, and here's what you can do in personam. So what's the best place for us to look and find authority for just what you said was, here's what in rem deals with. It's only the property.
Well, Your Honor, I think the general definition of the two, which is contained in probably hundreds, maybe thousands of years of case law. I think if you go back to early England, you can find the distinction. But in the statute, and you know, it's important that the legislature is trying to draft a statute that has broad application, and nothing that the legislature can ever do can cover every conceivable circumstance. So they lay out a series of circumstances or situations where the jurisdiction of the court can be invoked and what can occur. You then, the parties and the court then have to examine that statute and say, all right, given that statute, what is the appropriate kind of jurisdiction? If the legislature had simply intended that this is the list and the court can do whatever it wants in any circumstance, then the entirety of 501c0203 would be irrelevant. It wouldn't be necessary. And that's really what respondents are arguing, that none of that matters. So,
Mr. White, I had a question sort of following up on Judge Jushin's question. So I'm trying to get a feel for if the court only has in rem jurisdiction, what it can and cannot do. And obviously you're saying one thing it cannot do would be to remove the trustee. If it has in rem jurisdiction over the trust, could it order the trustee to disperse or not disperse funds?
That would be dealing with the property, Your Honor. So yes,
I know.
In an in rem proceeding, yes.
So it could do that. So could it order the trust? So what, I guess maybe a better question would be, what couldn't it do besides not removing the trustee? What could it not do if it only has in rem jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I think if it only has in rem your jurisdiction, the other set of issues that would have to be separated out, if you will, would be the language of the trust itself. So if there's a dispute over the language of the trust, then all of those very specific requirements of in personam jurisdiction and service and everything else would be triggered.
You know, would you agree that apart from in personam and in rem jurisdiction, the court has inherent authority to remove a trustee?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's statutory.
Okay. So if it could do that without referring to which jurisdiction, why wouldn't we just affirm on those grounds that, well, you know, the court could do it anyway if it wanted to, so it did here. So why is that position wrong?
Your Honor, first, the court hasn't done it. The hearing hasn't happened and so forth. We're just arguing over whether the court can. But I think the important issue there, Your Honor, is that the inherent authority to do that is simply insufficient on the facts of this case. In order to do that—
Because there's no indication that the trust is being looted?
Exactly, Your Honor. And if you look at Hormel's trust, where the court said you have the inherent authority, it said it's in an emergency kind of authority. And so it's not a situation where you can, to use that old law school phrase, bootstrap your way into jurisdiction by filing an in rem petition and then convincing a court to take on the in personam jurisdiction cloak, if you will, to decide whether to remove the trustee. There has to be either a specific emergency kind of situation or a specific set of procedures. And even, Your Honor, if the court had the inherent authority, there has to be a procedure to invoke it. If the court is going to do it, it has to set up a procedure to do it. And the typical procedure for something like that, I think, would be in order to show cause. So if the court became concerned because a filing came in of a partial accounting that something looked amiss, the judge could issue an order and say, everybody show up and let's talk about this specific issue. And if what I think is going on is going on, trustee, you're out of here. I'm going to remove you.
Mr. White, why do we even have to get to whether there is or isn't, you know, evidence of nefarious conduct, which could have the district court exercise this jurisdiction where we don't have here, as I understand it, any, you know, wouldn't you still at least have to give notice to the trustee?
Absolutely.
And I'm just not sure how far we need to go down that route.
Well, I think you're right, Your Honor. Someplace, somebody has to say, you're not doing your job as a trustee, and here's the 1, 2, 47 reasons why, whether that's the court or a petitioner. And then it has to be served personally. And the legislature has been very specific about that. That was not done here. And it's not just the petition that has to get served. It's also the order setting the hearing that has to get served personally in order to invoke in personam jurisdiction. None of that was done here. None of the beneficiaries were served, which is also a requirement of the statute, even though they can be served by mail. Again, I think that emphasizes that in the legislature's mind, its intent is the importance of this separate notion of in personam jurisdiction and the limited function that it serves and the necessity to jump through a lot more hoops in order to invoke the in personam jurisdiction, none of which were done here.
Mr. White, what is the meaning of the section 0.0208, which says sections 201 to 207 do not limit or abridge the power or jurisdiction of the court over trusts, trustees, and beneficiaries?
Well, Your Honor, I think that just says what it says. The court has the jurisdiction, the legal authority to take on, to address issues in a trust, much as section 501c.026 is kind of the minimum contacts statute to get rid of that set of problems. So you've got the legislature trying to write these kind of broad language about what the court can do, but then the legislature sets up specific procedures in order to enforce whatever right it is you're trying to enforce. And the 208 section still requires the court to do something. I mean, you can't remove a trustee without notice. I think all would agree with that. I think all would agree that you can't remove a trustee without a hearing so that the trustee can come in and say, what you're alleging is false. Here's the explanation. So,
Mr. White, I have my next question, separate question, stepping back a minute. This statutory scheme was adopted in 2015. What role does case law interpreting prior statutes play? In other words, I mean, is there some provision in the statute that instructs courts to continue to apply the former case law or the case law interpreting the former statutes, or because we're being cited with a modern statute and a lot of old case law, and I'm just wondering what is the relevance of the old case law?
Well, Your Honor, I think the old case law generally has extremely limited application. So if you look at the Wharton case, which is discussed, and at the Bush's Trust case that is discussed, both of those were interpreting the specific statutory language that existed at the time. You can look to some of those older cases for general principles about how trusts and estates are supposed to be handled. So, for example, Hormel's trust and its emergency authority for court removal is kind of a general proposition that the courts have applied again for a very long time, and certainly since Hormel's trust. And so the answer to your question, unfortunately, I think is it depends. And so you have to go through exactly what point of law is it that you're trying to invoke from the old case law and compare that to the statutory language and make sure that the two still mesh. To the extent that the language is identical or functionally identical, then the old case law probably still has application.
So if I can just make sure I understand what you're asking us to do, Mr. White. So the district court held its hearing and issued an order denying your client's motion to dismiss, saying, look, it had only in rem jurisdiction, but that's enough to give it jurisdiction over your client, right?
Yes.
So are you asking us to say, well, I mean, just to clarify, make sure, send it back and say, yeah, but having jurisdiction also doesn't mean you don't have to have notice and hearing. Is that at the end of the day what you're asking us to do?
I think, Your Honor, at the end of the day, the only thing we're asking you to do is to reverse that order and remand the case And then the respondent can decide whether or not she wishes to prepare an appropriate petition that specifically invokes the in rem juris or the in personam jurisdiction, asking the court to file an amended petition, since under our civil rules, you have to have court authority or consent. So either getting consent or court authority, and the plaintiff, Ms. Swanson, can decide whether she wants to jump through those hoops or not, given the passage of time. But for this court, the only thing that we're asking you to do at this point is to stop the hearing that was to be scheduled on the removal of the trustee and to send the case back for the court to secure in personam jurisdiction, however that gets accomplished. So, Your Honors, Your Honor, could Judge Johnson, could I summarize briefly?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, you may. You may sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think as the colloquy here demonstrates, the problem in this case is that the respondent attempted to do something that the statutes simply do not allow, and to take shortcuts and to circumvent the very specific requirements that the legislature put in place. We are asking this court to reverse the district court and then convince the district court to go along with that theory. We're asking this court to reverse the district court to recognize that distinction between in rem and in personam jurisdiction and the significance of the procedures that lead up to that, and to send the case back to the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. White. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Dan Bellig for the respondent, Marcia Swanson. I'd like to start by just kind of highlighting a couple of odd things going on in this case that I think are actually quite relevant. The first is that Wolf herself, the appellant here, has filed her own petitions seeking instructions from the court, and now is claiming that the court doesn't have authority over her because the respondent engaged in some sort of procedural defect in how it gave notice of the hearings. A little bit odd in my mind. In my mind, if you come in and say, court, tell me what to do, the court now has jurisdiction over you, I think there's a waiver there. The second part is what we're hearing from counsel is a complaint.
Mr. Bellick, in this petition that Mr. White filed, did he assert in personam jurisdiction?
They knew they would have a problem in my mind. So what their petition says is we're asserting in rem jurisdiction, but the relief we want is give me instructions as if you have authority over me. So if you liberally construe that pleading, they're asserting in personam jurisdiction. That's the relief they're asking for. The second point, one of the quirks here is that we're talking about were procedures followed.
If I may just dive into that a bit, but I thought, and so you know the record better than I do, and so correct me where I'm wrong, but that as far as your amended petition for the trust, it was included accounting, trust supervision, right, and removal. And I thought that appellants here weren't objecting to the accounting because that would be appropriate under NREM jurisdiction, right? So it seems it's not like they're, wouldn't you say that's not a waiver, that's just saying, agreeing that in-rim jurisdiction applies to some of what you're asking for, but not all of it.
Yeah, Your Honor, I'm referring to Ms. Wolf's own petitions. So Ms. Swanson has her petition for removal, and then Ms. Wolf has two petitions saying, court, I'm asserting in-rim jurisdiction, but by the way, go ahead and exercise personal jurisdiction because I'm requesting the relief that you give me specific instructions. So if she's requesting that sort of personal type relief in her own petition, how can she complain that there's no personal jurisdiction on the other petitions? It doesn't make practical or logical sense. The other issue is,
back to this issue about what do we mean when we're talking about in personam jurisdiction, isn't it kind of the minimum context part, the basis for acting, which could come, as I think you point out, under 501c.0206 versus, but you got to have notice, you know, and you've got to have service.
Right. And so that's what I want to talk about is really what's being missed, I think, on the appellant's end is a distinction between jurisdictional provisions in the statute and 203, which Bush's trust would say, based under a prior version, is a procedural aspect. And so if I can develop that a little bit, the other oddity I want to mention is they're complaining that they haven't got the required 15-day notice on a hearing that is no longer even on the calendar because of this appeal. So there's really nothing to review here because the notice requirement has now changed based on the proceedings below. This appeal is actually kind of moot. So that's kind of the other interesting quirk. But that, if I could give you the framework that I think the court should go through in sort of addressing this issue, I think it gets you to the same answer, but I think there's a path to go. The first is the waiver. I've talked about that. The second step then is, does the court have authority to remove on its own initiative? That's a straightforward answer right out of 501c.0706. I mean, it's right in the statute. There's nothing in there that limits that power whatsoever. So, but even if the court were to disagree with me, and that's regardless of the type of petition that's filed or the type of notice that's given, okay?
But
now, there may be due process concerns over if the court holds a hearing without notice, but that's not a jurisdictional question. That's a process question. And the reason that's important is because this is an interlocutory appeal. The only question here is jurisdiction, not proper process. If they have a process complaint, that happens after the hearing is held. That has not happened yet.
But would you agree, Mr. Bellick, that jurisdiction depends on notice?
Not in this case. The statute is different. There's a different trigger for jurisdiction over a trustee, and that is 501c. 0.0206. The trigger for jurisdiction under the trust code is the trustee's acceptance of the trusteeship. That is the jurisdictional provision. That is the jurisdictional trigger.
Okay, but what about 203 sub 2, which is the second sentence of 203 sub 2, you know, and the caption there is in personam judicial proceedings. First sentence talks about in personam jurisdiction. Second sentence says notice of the judicial proceeding must be given to it by in the manner set forth under Rule 4. So
right.
I mean, so doesn't that provision require notice?
It does as a procedural matter, not as a jurisdictional matter. So, for example, this statute is saying something akin to, you know, if you're going to file a motion for summary judgment, you have to do it on 28 days notice. If you're going to have a hearing on a petition, matter in a petition that involves in personam type jurisdiction, you need to do it on 14 days notice. And here's the service requirements. But the question of whether the court has jurisdiction over the trustee, not whether the trustee has notice of the hearing, but whether the court has jurisdiction over that trustee is answered by 0.0206. And I think that's what Bush's trust is talking about, is there's a distinction in how these different provisions operate.
But Mr. White argues that there's kind of two strands to the concept of in personam jurisdiction. One is the due process requirements and minimum contacts. The second is process and notice. And so 206 may require the trustee to waive any minimum contacts due process argument, but that notice is always required. And why is that wrong?
I think because the whole premise of appellant's arguments is conflating a typical civil action with a trusteeship that is subject to a specific jurisdictional mandate.
Well, I just read a statute that says notice of the judicial proceeding must be given if there's in personam jurisdiction or if that's sought.
Right, but that's no different than the rules of civil procedure saying that you must give 28 days notice on a motion for summary judgment. It's a procedural provision.
I'm responding
to, case talks about that.
I'm responding to your statement that this is not an ordinary civil action, but I guess it seems to me that in both an ordinary civil action and in a trust proceeding, notice is essential. And in this case, notice is required by statute.
And that's what I want to be clear about. I'm not saying that notice is not essential as a procedural matter. That's fair. If they want to make a complaint after the hearing that they didn't have notice under 501c.0203, go for it. But the legislature has told us.
I'm unclear about, what's at issue is sort of elementary definitions of jurisdiction and procedure. Of course, I mean, the statute uses the term in personam jurisdiction, so it does seem jurisdictional. But also, if we look at, I don't know if you have 204 in front of you, but the second sentence here says, this is under sub 2, 204 sub 2, captioned in personam. Second sentence says, this order is binding on, first, a party who is served with notice of the judicial proceeding. So if you're telling me that notice is not essential for jurisdiction, then it just seems like, what's the point? You can't get an order that is binding on the person you want to bind without notice. So you may have jurisdiction, but what good does that do if you can't get effective relief?
Go one part of that sentence forward, Your Honor.
I see it. Go ahead.
0.0204 subdivision 2. The order is binding on 1, a party who is served with notice of the judicial proceeding, (2), a party who appears in the judicial proceeding. So it's binding on Ms. Wolf. She has appeared not only to defend the action, but on her own petition. So the jurisdiction is there under 0206. She may not have had proper notice and can complain about that on a procedural grounds in a separate appeal after the hearing. But regardless, if the court finds that the notice was sufficient, she's bound by it simply because she appeared, because the court already has jurisdiction.
So is it your argument that ordinarily notice is required, but if notice is not given, its jurisdiction still is present, or at least a binding order still can be posed if, despite the lack of notice, a party appears? I don't remember you briefing that in your responsive brief, but
I think one of the issues we had, Your Honor, is that appellant didn't raise the substantive issues until her reply brief. So these issues didn't get really as developed as they could have been. But I think one of the reasons there's a case, Bearder v. State, and it involves the interpretation of a statute as to whether one part of the statute involves test data, one part of the statute involves biological samples. And it says these provisions have to be read as one affecting one affecting the other, otherwise it's a mess and a garble. And what I'm suggesting, and what I think the Supreme Court has already said under Bush's trust, is that 0206, 0208, those are jurisdictional statutes. The second part, 0203, is procedural. And I think a key point to make under that is if you look at the very last sentence of subdivision 2 of 0.0203, it says the district court shall have the discretion to order that notice of the judicial proceeding may be given in any other manner as the court directs. Now, if this were really a jurisdictional provision, the court wouldn't have that kind of discretion. You see that kind of discretion when it's more of a notice procedural type thing. And that's why I refer the court back to the McCullough case, where they try to draw those distinctions as to, is this jurisdictional, is this procedural? If you hold that 0.203, the notice requirements there are in fact a jurisdictional component, then what meaning does 0206 have when it says that the trustee submits to the personal jurisdiction of the court? That's wiped out.
Well, isn't that the answer that, as Mr. White suggests, that you're that's talking about the minimum contacts part of personal jurisdiction, not the notice. I mean, I must say, I am troubled by the idea that we would be interpreting statutes to give authority jurisdiction to district courts to remove a trustee without ever requiring notice and an opportunity to be heard. To, you know, it's a matter of statutory interpretation. And I know you've cited a lot of cases, but I'm just looking at this language from In Re Hormel's Trust that says the right of the trustee to hold and manage the estate, et cetera, is a valuable one which cannot be confiscated except for abuse of discretion, and then only on a petition of an interested party after due notice and opportunity to be heard. I mean, however many times that we change the trust code, that seems to be pretty fundamental to our jurisprudence.
And my answer to that, Your Honor, is if you go back to like the unpublished decision of Nothing, I'm saying that correctly, is they reversed there because there wasn't proper notice under 0203 or the similar language, but it wasn't a jurisdictional case. It wasn't reversed for lack of jurisdiction. It was reversed for lack of proper procedure. And this appeal cannot be a question of procedure because it's interlocutory. It's jurisdiction. Is there personal jurisdiction? 0206 says the trustee submits to the to personal jurisdiction of the court. If you put any other notice requirement from any other provision on there, that language, that separated provision becomes superfluous and meaningless. So the conclusion is any other provision then about notice or those sorts of requirements must be procedural rather than jurisdictional. And with that, I don't have enough time to dig much further, but if there are any other questions, I'd certainly answer them.
Mr. Bellick, my understanding based on the briefing by both parties is that prior to 2015, jurisdiction in probate, or excuse me, in trust cases was always considered in rem. Is that an overstatement or is that accurate? Is that essentially accurate?
I think what the cases would tell you is that, and I don't know if it's Bush's trust or if I'm misremembering which one it is. I think one of the cases specifically talks about how that distinction in trust actions has always been blurred.
But that in 2015, the legislature wanted to be more clear that there's two types of jurisdiction. There's in rem and there's in personam, and there's perhaps two different pathways, which doesn't preclude a petitioner from invoking both. It seems to me that the laundry list of subject matters in 202 is, you know, it might have been nice if the legislature had characterize them as one or the other or put them in their pigeonholes, and then that might help a few things. But anyway, but it seems like the legislature made a fundamental change in jurisdiction in trust cases. And so in light of that, it seems to me that case law from the prior regime is of not much value because there was just a different set of assumptions about the nature of the jurisdiction. But can you respond generally to that, please?
My response would be, I think you would have to pull the specific language of the statute considered in Bush's trust and compare that to the modern statute. And what I draw from Bush's trust is that they're quite similar with regard to the jurisdictional provisions. It may not be similar with respect to point 0202, where it has that long laundry list, but my take of Bush's trust is that although I don't think the exact statutory language is quoted there, the gist I take is that it's quite similar to what we have today. So to say, if you wanted to say, we're going to walk away from the jurisdictional procedural distinction talked about in Bush's trust, then you need to specifically look at here's the statutory language applied there. Here's the statutory language under the 215 trust code. Are they different enough that we can, you know, say stare decisis doesn't apply? The gist I get from my read is that you're not going to be able to reach that conclusion, but I don't have that sort of side-by-side comparison in front of me.
Thank you, Mr. Bellig. It appears that there are no further questions for you. Thank you for your argument. Mr. White, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin with the issue of what Nessing decided and refer you specifically to the first sentence in section 2 of that opinion, which appears at page 4 of the unpublished opinion that both parties have cited and relied on. And I quote this court, Nessing argues that the district court did not have jurisdiction to remove her as successor trustee of the Nessing Living Trust because Anderson did not follow statutory removal procedures. And this court concluded the failure to follow statutory notice requirements requires us to set aside Nessing's removal as trustee. So this court, the issue was framed as a jurisdictional question and Nessing by the parties. And this court came to the conclusion that as here, any effort to remove the trustee has to be or cannot occur without going through the proper notice. The second notice issue that I think is very important here, Your Honor, is counsel is delicately working his way around similar kinds of situations, talking about notice of summary judgment motions and similar kinds of hearings. That's not what we have here. Here we have a notice requirement to start the lawsuit. And the case law is absolutely clear and undisputed and universal that if you are going to start a lawsuit, you have to jump through the right hoops. And until you do, the court doesn't have jurisdiction, however you label it. Here, the statute sets out the jurisdictional requirements that were not followed. And so in personam jurisdictions, the district court found never got created. And this court has addressed that in WIC. Where the court noted, and admittedly it's procedurally and substantively different, but this court noted that you have to have both things. You have to have minimum contacts, personal jurisdiction. You also have to have the proper procedural hoops followed. And while I was doing some other research on another matter, Your Honor, I came across the Minnesota Supreme Court case in Leslie versus Emerson, which is at 889 Northwest 2nd 13 from 2017. And there, toward the end of the sixth section of the opinion at page 17, the court said, accordingly, the district court had subject matter jurisdiction as a court of general jurisdiction, but it exceeded its lawful authority when it used the wrong procedure to address the constitutional challenge. So again, procedures matter. And here, the proper procedures were not followed. The waiver argument fails for a multiple of reasons. First, it was never raised below, and thus this court cannot address it as it has been universally held, except if there is an independent basis upon which to do that, which is generally the interests of justice. Respondent made no argument about why the interests of justice were necessary to address a waiver argument. So again, this court has universally required that you make an argument, that you give some analysis. Wasn't done here. And so the argument itself is insufficient. And third, as is addressed in our brief, there was no waiver here. And I think, again, it's important to distinguish. Counsel makes much of the petitions that Wolf has filed. All of those petitions deal with how to handle the property, how to dispose of the property. That's classic in rem jurisdiction. Judge, I've got two parties who are fighting over who owns this piece of property. I'm stuck in the middle. You, Judge, you decide who gets it, and I'll do what I'm supposed to do, distribute it to the party who's supposed to get it. So that's the kind of classic in rem jurisdiction, and that's all Wolf has raised in her petitions.
Mr. White, related to the waiver argument, I think, is there's a statutory provision that might functionally do the same, and that's it was discussed during Mr. Bellig's argument, 204 sub 2 paren 2. In other words, you know, that's where under in personam jurisdiction, the order is binding on not just a party who is served with notice, but also a party who appears in the judicial proceeding. Could you please address that issue and perhaps respond to Mr. Bellig's oral argument about it?
Certainly, Your Honor. A party under our rules of civil procedure and case law, again, that goes back decades, is allowed to appear for a limited purpose. Here, Ms. Wolf made it clear that she was appearing in terms of the removal of the trustee for the limited purpose of challenging whether there was in personam jurisdiction, whether the court had the authority to remove her as trustee, given the documents that had been filed and were eventually sort of kind of served. So there's nothing unique about the situation we're in, Your Honor, where a party appears, but appears for the limited purpose of challenging whether I have to continue with the litigation. And we do that all the time. You raise the minimum contacts argument, if that's appropriate, and you appear only to argue the minimum contacts. It doesn't let the court grab you for all other purposes. And so that's all that Ms. Wolf did in her specific petitions and in responding to the petition initially filed by Ms. Swanson.
Your time has expired, Mr. White.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time of the court.
Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The matter is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. We will now make a transition to our third case for oral argument.